v. England. Ms. Lee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Joanne Lee, and I and my co-counsel, Ellen Wheeler and Tom Migrate, are here on behalf of defendant appellant, Mr. David England. Your Honors, for the sake of saving some time, I would submit that you rely on the briefs for a brief summary of the facts, and I'd like to talk just about the three arguments that are listed in our briefs. The first thing that I'd like to talk about is Mr. England's waiver of his right to counsel. As Your Honors know, courts consider generally four factors in determining whether or not a defendant knowingly and intelligently waived his right to counsel. And
Ms. Lee, you're right. We do know about the four factors, but what really struck me from this record was how thorough a discussion Mr. England had, first with the magistrate judge and then on a couple of occasions with Judge Reinhardt about that, to the point where Judge Reinhardt is saying to him, you know, describe an opening statement, describe cross-examination. And it just builds and builds. The magistrate judge begins with it. And I have to say, if that's not enough, it's really hard for me to imagine anything but overruling Ferretta to satisfy this.
Well, Your Honor is right. The district court, Judge Reinhardt, did give an investigation that was thorough or more thorough.
And he did so after the magistrate judge in the afternoon session of that first day had gone through what looked to me like a fairly typical inquiry, maybe a little bit too cursory, but then when it goes over to Judge Reinhardt for trial, he says, I know the magistrate judge has done this, but I'm just going to start all over again and satisfy myself that you know what you're doing. And that's really early on in the proceedings.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but I think that is the problem. If I could go back to the magistrate judge in the detention hearing on February 8, 2005, at the very morning part of that detention hearing, the judge doesn't even ask a single question before saying, I will grant your request at least for purposes of this hearing.
And what that means is 9 more pages of the transcript. I mean, it can't be more than another 5 minutes or so that goes on before then they recommence in the afternoon, right? And that's when Magistrate Judge Mahoney goes through the more detailed inquiry, right?
It is a more detailed inquiry, but I would submit, Your Honor, that it is still an adequate inquiry.
And there was no way he was going to accept a lawyer.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear.
You're being very unrealistic. There was no way that England was going to accept a lawyer to represent him.
Well, and that's part of the reason why we think that his background and perhaps the context in which his waiver was given finds against a waiver that was knowing and intelligent. Mr. England didn't decide not to use Paul Flynn or Denny Ryan.
I agree with Judge Wood. It's hard to imagine a case in which a stronger case for knowing a waiver of right to counsel.
But, Your Honor, I would say that Judge Reinhardt.
Much better argument on sentencing than you do on this.
Well, if Your Honor would like, I would be happy to move on to the count 4 conviction as well as the sentencing under the Booker test. To begin with count 4, Your Honors, we believe that there is insufficient evidence for a rational trier of fact to have found sufficient facts for a conviction under count 4.
Why does it matter under this statute that the intended victim subjectively be intimidated? Why isn't this an objective test applied ex ante, if you will?
Well, I'm not sure that the question is whether or not the intended victim, what they felt is the dispositive issue. The dispositive
issue.
But
you argued that was one of the key points. You keep saying that Robert testified later on, the sentencing, of course, there's some issue about that, but that Robert says he wasn't intimidated, thought that Mr. England was just, you know, a bunch of hot air, which maybe he was. But the question is, you know, when you have these kinds of threat cases where these transcripts we have from the government are just replete with Mr. England saying, I'm going to kill Robert, you know, as soon as I get out, I'm going to murder him. He says it in a number of different ways. He's made these threats. He's made it to somebody who he knows the target knows, his father. Why isn't that objectively, A, it's a serious threat objectively in terms of the conduct, and B, isn't there a reasonable expectation it would be communicated?
I don't think there is a reasonable expectation, and I think that's where
If somebody threatened, you know, a person's father, that another member of the family was going to be assaulted or murdered? You don't think it's likely to think that the father might pass that word along and say, hey, maybe you want to take a few precautions?
Well, I think that it really depends on the cases or the facts of a specific case. And in this case, Your Honor, we have repeated testimony that nobody took him seriously. And I believe that Mr. Ben England specifically stated many times...
See, that's where you're, I think, missing the point. The point is not whether anyone in fact took him seriously. Is it the kind of threat that people do, in general, take seriously?
Well, Your Honor, in this specific case, the reason that the United States Seventh Circuit has, the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit has said that there needs to be a reasonable tendency to intimidate is because it provides circumstantial evidence as to the defendant's intent. And in this case, what we're trying to say is that if Mr. England, the defendant, has been told by his father repeatedly, I'm not going to relay any messages, I'm not even talking to these people that you want me to talk to, with regard to what he knew at the time he made these statements, his intent was not to prevent the testimony because he knew his father would never relay any of those messages. So it's not necessarily dispositive what Mr. Robert Bull thought about those statements or whether he felt intimidated by them, but there's certainly a factor that weighs into whether or not Mr. England had the requisite intent under 1512A.
Let me ask you about the 2A2.1 versus 2J1.2.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it seems to me in the post-Booker era, which we're in, what we have here is a situation where neither of the available guidelines is a 100% perfect fit to this man's conduct. And we do have the instruction to look at 2A2.1 from the appendix. But one way or the other, since the judge is entitled to impose a reasonable sentence, and indeed is compelled to impose a reasonable sentence in the end, if one of the guideline references is a little too stringent, he can go down.
Yes.
If the other is a little too lenient, he can go up. And it looked to me like Judge Reinhart did just what he was supposed to do. He calculates the guidelines range as well as he can, and then he steps back and says, okay, now 3553A, does this guideline range really match what I need to do for Mr. England? And, of course, he concludes yes. But I don't see why we have to get obsessed about which guideline is the reference when that discretion exists now in the system.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the reason for maybe the obsession was because that Judge Reinhart himself felt very tied at the very beginning of the sentencing hearing. You'll see that he felt that there was some difficulty with applying 2A2.1 because there was a clear inconsistency with what Mr. England was convicted for, which was this threat with the intent to delay and the express application of 2A2.1, which applies to attempted murder or assault with intent to commit murder. Now, that difficulty was never translated into his analysis under 3553. He never thought about that difficulty and whether or not that could warrant a downward departure. He went through his very, typical analysis under 3553 and never thought maybe those difficulties that I had in applying 2A2.1 could also come into play in his analysis of 3553. And
that is
the problem.
What if he was just looking at the sentencing range, though, at that point and saying, does this seem to me to fit Mr. England? Why is it important at that stage that he go back to whether the sentencing guidelines were a good fit or not?
Well, I believe that the Seventh Circuit...
What you're saying is that the logic of his opinion is that if this person were an attempted murderer, he'd get the same sentence.
If he...
So it creates an unwarranted disparity. Isn't that
yes,
the problem?
Yes, that is...
The judge didn't look at the unwarranted disparity provision in 3553A.
Exactly. And I think that if he had taken that into consideration, and the fact that he didn't is a problem here. And ultimately, Mr. England got sentenced for something that he didn't ever do. He never attempted to commit murder, and he certainly didn't commit assault with the intent to commit murder, and yet he was sentenced for those crimes. And I think that it's telling, Your Honor, that under the sentencing guidelines, no matter what the scenario were, whether he had a zero criminal history, whether he had no other aggravating circumstances, if count four was the only count for which he was sentenced, he would still be sentenced, according to the sentencing guidelines, for a sentence that exceeded the statutory maximum that's provided for under 1512. And that in itself should have guided the court when it did its 3553 analysis. But again, there's nothing in the record that shows that he even considered that as a factor. And for those reasons, I think that the sentence should be vacated. And I see that my time has run out, unless Your Honors have any other questions.
Ms. Mallory?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Monica Mallory, and I'm appearing for the United States.
Well, I'm very troubled by the sentencing, because it looks as if he used a guideline which provides the same sentence for attempted murderers and threateners, and then when he got around to considering the statutory factors, he forgot to consider whether by the use of that guideline he was creating an unwarranted disparity, because he'd forgotten, it seems, I mean, just judging from the transcript, that there's a real problem with this guideline, right?
Well,
he did was look at individual factors, which is fine. And those are individual factors that didn't count in favor of the defendant. That's fine. But he ends up sentencing him as he would if the defendant had been an attempted murderer, which seems pretty strange.
Well, but he did say at the point in time where he was analyzing the applicability of 2A2.1 that even if it were found that it wasn't applicable under the circumstances of this offense, he would have considered an upward variance. At that point in time...
Maybe he would have, sure. But that doesn't mean he would have gone all the way up to the attempted murder level.
Well, that's true, Your Honor. The court did consider the 3553 factors, and he
didn't consider the right one. The critical thing is not whether this is, a good guy, is going to be rehabilitated or anything like that. He doesn't have anything going for him on that front. The real problem is that there's a screw-up in the guidelines. And one of the advantages of Booker is that now it's very easy for a judge to correct that kind of screw-up.
Yes, Your Honor.
The judge didn't seem to have been... he's very mechanical. So first of course, we've told them, and the Supreme Court has said, you have to compute the guideline sentence absolutely first. And then you proceed to 3553A, which is a good discipline. But the fact that you're in 3553A doesn't mean that you ignore any problems that might have arisen in computing that initial guideline sentence.
But he did look to the circumstances of this
offense. He didn't look at the difference between an attempted murderer and a threatener. That's what he didn't look at.
Right. He didn't find that the guideline was a good fit, and he said that.
He didn't? Right. It's a bad fit. Well, that bad fit ought to be reflected in his discussion of sentencing. Now, he could say, look, there's the bad fit. Guideline sentence is the same for an attempted murder and as for a threatener. But this guy is so dangerous that it's perfectly appropriate to sentence him as if he were an attempted murderer. And if he'd said that, fine. But he didn't say that. We have no idea whether when he came to apply the sentencing factors, he was remembering that there is a problem with the guidelines, with his starting point.
He talked about this defendant's history and how his
That's
history...
not the point. The point is, this guy is not an attempted murderer. Now, if you want to say he's as bad as an attempted murderer and should be sentenced accordingly, that's fine. But the judge didn't say that.
John? Well, I believe the judge properly selected 2A2.1 because the judge had to, and then I do believe that he considered whether or not he should depart downward or do a variance downward from that. He may not have articulated it as thoroughly.
See, that old-fashioned variance downward language, that just shows someone who's not thinking in the Booker world. Booker world, remember, we've said we presume a guideline sentence is proper. We do not permit district judges to presume that guideline sentences are proper.
And I don't believe this district court judge did.
There's no other way to interpret what he did. He found the guideline sentence, and he was only going to give a different sentence based on individual characteristics of the defendant. He wasn't going to look back and say, is there a misfit in the guidelines which I ought to correct?
Well, but when he did make the comment that he would have varied upward...
He didn't say he would sentence this fellow as if he had attempted a murder. That's what I'm...
He may not... You're right. He did not precisely say, I would vary upward into this range. He did not say that. And I don't know what he would have said if he had been pushed on that point, Your Honor. But he did properly consider the 3553 factors for this defendant and considered his history, the nature and circumstances of the offense, and his observations of England during the proceedings. He also properly grouped the offenses, despite the argument in opposing counsel's briefs. He grouped the obstruction offenses, and then he combined them with the 922G, and he selected the highest level, and it was driven by that count four of 33. And he properly sentenced England using that total punishment that he had selected from that, using consecutive sentences to reach the total punishment that he had selected from the advisory range. With respect to the evidence and its sufficiency, we believe the district court properly instructed the jury on the elements of the violation of 1512. The government tendered the language that was drawn directly from the statute. The jury was instructed on that language, that the defendant used the threat of physical force against a person, in this case Robert Bull, intending to prevent his testimony in a future official proceeding, and that he did so knowingly. We don't see in 1512 that there's a requirement that the government established as an element that there was a reasonable tendency to intimidate the person by the threat. It's a threat of physical force.
20 years, pretty long for a threat?
It is, but it's capped by the statutory max. The guidelines provide for that. Had he been convicted of only a count four, we would not see a sentence of 20 years. We would have seen it capped by the statutory max, 10 years, similar to what he would have been capped at for the involuntary manslaughter that he raises in his brief as being a similar type offense that he didn't get charged with. So there is protection there for the defendant, as well as the Booker protections. So he would have been capped by the guidelines.
Ms. Mallory, did you notice this change of the location of intimidation and threat of physical force from 02 to 05?
Yes.
And what is your read of the Sentencing Commission? It seems to me didn't appear to reflect the movement.
Not specifically, but I guess...
Yeah, well...
let me describe sure. What I have been able to discern. Yes, in 2002 and 2003, the statute changed and moved this up.
Right.
If you look at the index in 2000, which is where we first hear that we have to apply the index, you'll see that it's broken out 1512 A, B, C, and D. B is the only part of 1512 at that time that dealt with threats. And if you look at that section or that year of the index, you'll notice that it includes 2A, 1.2, I believe, and 2. So it does include some of the 2A guideline sections still at that point. So it graduates, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but doesn't the statutory maximum become only 10 years?
Excuse me?
If no one dies?
Right. But the guideline still refers you to those guideline sections for...
Yeah, but is that perhaps a Scrivener's error? That's my inquiry. I mean, because it makes it's kind of a stark, sort of a double up, right? I mean, it goes from what would be 10 to 20.
Well, yes, I guess true. But as I said, if you're just charged with a count, a 1512 A2 count, you're going to be limited by that statutory max, which is also 10 years. What we have here is we have a defendant charged with four charges and convicted of all four. So the limitation didn't apply to him.
What would his sentence... So he got 262 months, that's his sentence. What would it have been if there hadn't been the count four charge?
Oh, it would have been in the, I think, 80 to 100 range.
80 to 100?
I'd have to look back at the briefings for that.
So if it would have been 80, and so 100, that would be 182 extra months for the intimidation. So that's 15 years for the threat? Isn't that a little steep?
Well, as your opponent points out, when the statutory maximum isn't even that long.
The statutory maximum is 10 years.
Right, so it's not 15 years.
Right. So, I mean, we'd still be covered by that statutory maximum.
Yes, but that's a different analysis. Just thinking, what is the proper sentence for a threat? Doesn't 15 years seem long for a threat?
For a threat, perhaps, but for a threat of physical force, I don't believe so. I believe a threat of physical force is significant.
What's an attempted murderer get?
Excuse me?
You know, you've got a problem with marginal deterrence. If you keep jacking up sentences for lesser crimes, what would an attempted murderer get?
Just on an attempted murder charge?
Yeah.
It would be probably dictated by the statutory max. I'd have to look at the guidelines.
And then the actual murderer. So you get a compression. How old was this fellow?
He's 26, or he was at the time of trial.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hey, thanks very much. So do you have anything further, Ms. Lee? Your time had expired. You can have a minute if you have... Excuse me?
A minute would be...
Okay, that's fine.
Your Honors, just to address counsel's point regarding the upward variance, Justice Posner pointed out, the problem is that he didn't do the analysis, and it's pretty much a red herring. The judge actually pointed out, well, the government never asked for it. I never ran the analysis. And as counsel pointed out, I don't know what he would have said if he had actually ran the analysis. Second of all, under Booker, he would not have been able to give an upward variance that ran into the 210 to 262-month range, because under 2J1.2, he would have been restrained under the statutory maximum of 120 months.
But the statutory maximum, when you have multiple counts, operates differently, since it is, as 5G points out, always possible to impose consecutive sentences without violating the statutory maximum.
Yes, but under 5G1, there has to be the statutory maximum cannot be enough to provide for the total punishment. And I will rely on the briefs again without boring you with the numbers, but if you actually ran the analysis under 2J, the statutory maximum would be sufficient. As counsel suggested, it ran up to 105 months under that scenario, and therefore 120 months would have been sufficient. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lee. And you were appointed. So we thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of the